From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm Ray Kirstein. Your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, is traveling, so I've got the privilege of filling in this week from Leipzig, Germany. This program is made possible in part by generous support from you, our listeners. You know, the end of the year is starting to creep closer. It's October, and your gift to State of Belief is tax-deductible. Find out more at stateofbelief.com, and I sure hope you'll consider making a contribution to keep the show on the air. On our interfaith calendar, Monday is the celebration of Thanksgiving up in Canada. Tuesday marks the beginning of the festival of Navaratri in the Hindu tradition, and sundown on Tuesday brings the Muslim observance of New Year, Hijra. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
We are not the only country on earth that has people with mental illnesses or want to do harm to other people. We are the only advanced country on earth that sees these kinds of mass shootings every few months. The United States of America is the one advanced nation on earth in which we do not have sufficient common sense gun safety laws, even in the face of repeated mass killings.
The president was clearly frustrated and angry, but even he didn't sound hopeful as he addressed the nation right after the latest mass shooting, this one on a community college campus in Oregon. Survivor groups have been getting better organized to lobby for change, but the death grip the NRA and other pro-gun outfits seem to hold on most legislators appears to be bulletproof. To gauge if we've made any progress this week, we'll revisit a couple of compelling past broadcast conversations around this topic, part of our preparation for this show's 10th anniversary in January 2016. Later in the show, we'll explore a significant faith-based initiative on this vital national issue with the Reverend Martin Copenhaver, president of Andover Newton Theological School, which hosts a two-day summit later this month titled Subverting the Gospel of Guns. But first,
absolute chaos today in American politics. Everything we thought was going to happen did not happen. And House Republicans burst out of that room like a house on fire. They said they were stunned, mayhem. A number of Republican members of Congress were crying inside the meeting room.
It's been a heck of a week for political news junkies. Outlandish comments by presidential candidates, leadership chaos in the House of Representatives, not to mention the entry of Russia into the Syrian "it's not a war zone." To sort through some of this, I'm happy that we can call upon Greg LaBelle, assistant professor of political management at George Washington University and someone with real-life experience in national political campaigns. Greg, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks. Good to be back.
So let's start with these anti-Muslim comments we heard from Ben Carson about a week and a half ago. That came after Donald Trump edged into the issue. Why is there no price to pay for candidates for this kind of rhetoric? And if it's working for them, is there going to be more, do you think?
Well, I think in the short term, there's no price to pay because they're actually appealing to the voters that they need to appeal to. They are both pitching their messages to that extreme right corner of the Republican Party who actually believe this stuff. And so they're making the pitch to the folks that they need to make the pitch to in the short term in terms of trying to keep their numbers up as they look at the nomination. The question is whether that's enough. But for right now, it's working because they're the people they want to be talking to.
What do you think it tells us about the broader electorate? Do you think people just aren't paying attention yet?
I think that that's a part of it. I think people are not paying attention. I don't think a lot of people outside of that little corner of the right wing actually take Donald Trump particularly seriously. So that may be one of the reasons why people aren't paying a lot of attention to him. I think a lot of people don't know who Ben Carson is. So that's another thing. And as you said, the third reason is a lot of people just aren't focused on this yet. It seems it's not high on their list of things to pay attention to right now.
So let's shift to Capitol Hill for a minute and what's been happening there. The chaos with the speaker nomination. Greg, did you hurt yourself shaking your head at what was going
what
on there?
Crazy week this has been. Neither thing I think anyone expected. I mean, the Boehner resignation was absolutely mind-blowing. My jaw dropped down when I heard it. It's utter chaos. I mean, the outward battle that's going on within the Republican Party in the House of Representatives is really spectacular. I mean, it's like watching a car crash, and I don't think anybody knows how it's gonna work itself out yet.
There was an interesting little side note to the story on Thursday when they were expecting to vote for Speaker. After things fell apart in the closed room, lawmakers were heard crying through the door. Do you think that was a tribute to John Boehner?
Or a tribute or something to John Boehner, I'm not sure. I had not heard that, but I guess we shouldn't be surprised by that, because I think the mainstream Republicans, the few of them that are left over there or who will admit it, I think are real concerned about what this means about their ability to govern in the way that they think, and I think the majority of Americans think we need to be governed.
Greg, you know, it's really noteworthy how it's the outsiders that are the only ones that are making any headway in the presidential campaign. It's so much of an issue in the House Speaker election, too. I have this theory that this kind of grew out of the Reagan time, when it really was a successful tactic to kind of criticize and undermine government in general as untrustworthy. Do you see this possibly as a sign that the chickens are coming home to roost?
I don't think it's crazy. I think that that you're right that Ronald Reagan started this idea that his line about what's wrong with us is we have too much government. Government is the question was are you afraid of your government? And his answer was yes. As a matter of fact, I am afraid of my government. I think that probably has been festering in corners of the Republican electorate for a long time. I think we have seen an increasing number of folks who subscribe to that sentiment, winning particularly seats in the House of Representatives. So you've got this Freedom Caucus of about 40 members now who are somehow convinced that the House of Representatives is in fact the sole ruling body in the United States, and if they don't get their way, then you know the president is lawless, and the Supreme Court is acting unconstitutionally, and so on and so forth. There's this sort of crazy lack of understanding of what the American political system actually is that seems to be holding the upper hand in the House of Representatives right now.
Now, here's the scary part for me. Has there ever been a time when this level of chaos got sorted out by something less than a national or global crisis?
That's a good question. And it's kind of a frightening question. I think that to look at the larger issue, I think to look at the division in this country around issues like gay marriage and black-white relationships and women's reproductive health issues have come back to the fore with a vengeance. And of course that whole question about what is religious liberty and where are the lines and so on and so forth, and what does that mean in the context of a democracy? I mean, these lines are really pretty intense, and I don't want to overstate it, but I think historically the last time we've seen this kind of division in the country, and if you look geographically, it's very similar. I would say that was the 30 years before the Civil War.
Well, we certainly weren't around for that. But
yeah, like I said, I don't want to overstate it, but historically, I mean, these are the kinds of issues that are dividing us, and again, dividing us geographically.
So, not to make this a lightning round, but there are so many issues out there that we really need to hear from you on. I want to move on to the Benghazi committee hearings. What do you think is going to happen there now after the revelations from Kevin McCarthy? Do you think the Democrats are going to maybe go ahead and drop out?
Oh, Kevin McCarthy gave Hillary Clinton such a gift on Benghazi with his intemperate remark about how this was really, or unintended remark maybe, about how this was really all about bringing down her numbers. This allows Clinton and the Democrats to go into this thing and make the issue less about Clinton and more about the legitimacy of the hearing itself. This is that I can imagine the folks in the Clinton campaign were absolutely jubilant when they saw that quote. He's really taken the wind out of it, and I think the Republican leadership understands that. And I think that has something to do with his inability to pull together all the votes that he needed to move up to the speakership.
But you do think the Democrats will stay on the committee?
I think they can. I think that the committee has been put in a situation where it has to defend itself now as a result of the majority leader's remarks. So yeah, I think they can play it out that way.
All right. So how much are you looking forward to the first Democratic debate coming up this week, Greg?
Not as much as I looked forward to the second Republican debate, but it'll certainly be interesting. I think that it'll be a quieter affair. I think that tactically, each of the candidates probably knows that it's not in their best interest to be at their worst behavior vis-a-vis the others on the stage. I think Bernie Sanders has an opportunity for the first time to introduce himself to a lot of people who aren't edgy liberals, edgy white liberals in the Democratic Party. Hillary Clinton has the opportunity and the necessity, I think, to present herself as someone who is trustworthy. Martin O'Malley, I think, needs to see this as an opportunity to breathe a little life into his campaign as becoming a more viable alternative to Hillary Clinton than he's been perceived thus far. And frankly, I think Webb and Chafee just kind of go along for the ride.
Do you think they'll all be kind of running away from Obama?
Yes and no. I think Clinton has been carving out some issues where she differs from Obama, and this is in part because she needs to bring about some incursions into Bernie Sanders' territory. I think that each of them will have issues that will separate them from the current administration. I think that's not unusual. I think that at the end of any two-term presidency, the candidates to succeed from the incumbents' party have to draw some lines between themselves and where the current president is. And I think that's understandable and expected.
Greg, you've worked on presidential campaigns. You've been in some of those rooms when the sweat was dripping. How much sweat do you think was dripping in the White House this past week when Russia involved itself in the non-war in Syria and began shelling the rebels?
I think there's certainly a lot of concern and confusion about what's going on, what Russia is actually up to and willing to do. To some extent, though, I think it's not a total surprise. I think that Russia's actions in the last few days actually have probably allowed some of the sweat to stop a little bit, because I think the administration sort of recognizes, and I think they're right, that Russia could easily overstep its bounds in this situation and get itself into a much bigger quagmire than they want to be in. I mean, that's such a complicated mess over there. It's almost impossible not to see that happen. So I think that, you know, that's why we haven't heard that much from the administration on this front. I think they're taking sort of a wait and see approach, because I think they're convinced that the Russians are going to find themselves in a very different situation than they thought they were, as has been the case with pretty much anyone who's gotten engaged over there over the last decade.
So, Greg, is there anything else you're keeping an eye on, watching with bated breath, making sure your students are paying attention to?
Well, I think we've talked about them, though. I think that the Benghazi hearings are going to be fascinating. But I think the point is that they all tie together. I think the Benghazi hearings, the debate, the continuing saga of Hillary Clinton's emails, and now this utter disarray in the House of Representatives, all sort of roll in together, and each affects the other thing. And so I think that what's going to be really interesting in the next 2 or 3 weeks is to see how each impacts the others, and where we are at the end of October may be very, very different from where we were when we went into this month.
We watch this stuff all the time. When do you think normal Americans really start paying attention? When do they start thinking and talking about politics?
I'll tell you. As you know, I grew up in New Hampshire and cut my teeth on the New Hampshire presidential primaries for years. And even in New Hampshire, where, you know, we're sort of legendary for being so plugged into the process, I will tell you that even there, I remember going out door to door and talking with people a week before the primary and having people look at me with surprise and say, oh, you mean the primary's next week? So I don't think we can overestimate the amount of time we have before the rest of the country really starts paying attention to what's going on here. There are too many other things that are taking up people's time. So we've got plenty of time for lots of changes to occur. There's no question about that. And I think what I've been happy to hear is oftentimes now when people are talking about polls, polling data, they're saying, you know, we have to recognize that these polls really don't mean very much, if anything, in the long term. But it doesn't take away, I think, from the strangeness of this of the discourse that we're seeing, particularly on the Republican side with this particular collection of candidates this time. But we got lots of time before mainstream voters start really focusing on this and thinking about what they're going to do.
Well, that's a big relief, Greg, because, I mean, by that time, everything will be back to normal.
Whatever that is.
Greg LaBelle is assistant professor of political management at George Washington University. Having worked inside several presidential campaigns, today he serves as director of the Semester in Washington Politics, as well as the Native American Political Leadership Program at GWU. Greg, as always, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
It's good to talk to you. Have a good day.
Gun violence in America. Going back through the archives, we've addressed this issue so many times and in so many different ways, it was nearly impossible to decide which segments to replay on this week's show. But in 2010, Dr. Julie Ingersoll was with us talking about an article she'd published in Religion Dispatches magazine, along with journalist Sarah Posner, headlined, Gun Ownership, An Obligation to God. The insights Dr. Ingersoll brought to that conversation are well worth revisiting today, because they go a long way toward helping us understand why opposition to common sense gun control laws remains so entrenched, and in suggesting what it will really take for change to happen.
While constitutional scholars and historians still don't agree on what the curiously worded Second Amendment actually decrees, for some, it has become an article of faith that it gives the right to own, use, and openly carry firearms in city and country and private residence and places of public gathering. And guns can be central not just to national identity, but to religious identity as well. Today, we welcome back to State of Belief Julie Ingersoll, who recently co-wrote an article for Religion Dispatches entitled Gun Ownership, An Obligation to God. She and Sarah Posner wrote that piece together. Julie is coordinator and a professor in the Religious Studies program at the University of North Florida. She's a frequent contributor to Religion Dispatches. Julie, welcome back to State of Belief.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
In your story, you quote Gun Owners of America Executive Director Larry Pratt as saying, when we're talking about firearms, we're not really talking about a right, but an obligation as creatures of God to protect the life that was given them. Now, I may be wrong, but it seems to me that makes gun use sound more like a religious obligation than a legal right. Do I get it correctly?
Well, I think that they see the protection of themselves, their families, as a moral obligation, a biblical obligation given by God. And when they say protection, they mean from criminals, but they also mean from a tyrannical government. And I think as they see it, the possession of firearms is one very natural way to ensure that they're prepared to meet that obligation.
Where do they get the scriptural inspiration for that notion of religious obligation for gun use?
Well, the folks that Sarah and I wrote about are really relatively sophisticated thinkers. They aren't just going and finding some reference to a weapon. Broadly speaking, they think that God has ordained men to be leaders and protectors of their families. And that the tools that are available that allow men to meet that obligation are tools that men legitimately ought to have. In the essay that Sarah and I wrote, there's a quote there from an essay written by a Reconstructionist, Joel McDermott, mm-hmm. In which he actually does list a series of biblical citations. in the Hebrew Bible, Old Testament, in which practice of self-defense is lauded. The inability to defend oneself is indicated as slavery. Several different passages that appear in that essay.
In your story, Herb Titus, a lawyer for Gun Owners of America, says the Second Amendment isn't solely about firepower. You have to see it in its spiritual and providential perspective. Help us understand what he's meaning there.
Well, and I think this is something I wanted to clarify in your initial introduction. You talked about the Constitution giving this right, and in fact, that's not how they see it. It's very important to them that they construe this right in the Constitution as recognizing a right that already exists and codifying and protecting such a right. But the right, in their view, comes from God. And again, it's related to this obligation to protect those that they're obligated to protect.
I see.
If the government limits their right to own guns, it makes it impossible for them to obey God.
Do you know, would they see other civil rights in the same manner as this one?
Well, they do. I think that one thing that's not often understood is that they really do read the Constitution in the context of the Declaration of Independence. They almost always talk about those two documents together. And so before you have a Constitution, you have inalienable rights endowed by a creator.
I see.
Rights that are self-evident, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So the Constitution is seen as articulating and protecting those certain rights that came from God, and that's clear if you look at those two documents together, rather than the way most of us look at the Constitution as a document that stands on its own.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to them because the Constitution, obviously, in the Constitution, the founders decided not to mention the name of God or even a reference to deity, and so they need that for that kind of authority.
Exactly. The only references in the Constitution to religion are limited.
Are limiting, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, for the gun advocates in your article, the ability to resist tyranny is a critical part of their interpretation of the Second Amendment. Now, does that also have a religious component for them?
Oh, absolutely. You see in the essay that Sarah and I wrote, hints at this division between the Gun Owners of America and the National Rifle Association. And you would think that those two groups would be on the same page, and of course, often they are. But Gun Owners is pretty explicit, claiming the mantle of a truly Christian gun protection organization. And in fact, that has to do with their, first of all, concern that National Rifle Association compromises in places that gun owners would not, but also because Gun Owners of America defends the right to bear firearms in large measure in terms of interest in sporting events and hunting and things like that. Whereas Gun Owners is much more concerned with issues of government tyranny and the right of an individual to protect himself from the intrusion of government.
Well, it's also, interestingly, fits in with the Elena Kagan's confirmation hearings that have just concluded. There she was asked by Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley, if the Second Amendment codified a pre-existing right— or if it was a right created by the Constitution. You've already talked about the way they see that. Tell us how Titus reacted to Kagan's response.
Grassley, of course, asked where the right comes from, kind of like you did at the beginning of the interview.
Mm-hmm.
And Kagan's response was she hadn't really thought about it that way. And Titus was appalled that somebody sitting for a nomination at the Supreme Court would not have thought about that as a question. And of course, for Kagan, that's not unlike asking, you know, whether the rights come from the Constitution or from Zeus.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's not her worldview.
Right.
But I think that question by Grassley is a really important one, and I think it slid by without a lot of comment in the media and in the reporting about the hearings themselves, because I think that encapsulates this whole division over whether America is a Christian nation and what the founders really meant. And all of those issues are kind of wrapped up in that question, right? Where do these rights come from?
And I think a lot of people don't see that. That's really an important point you're making. And I think, too, Julia, that if you make that point that these rights are more basic than the Constitution and that they come from God, that means that the government authority is inferior to the authority of God, which opens the door to a very different view of government.
Well, different from whom? I think it is an important division. I mean, Martin Luther King made the same division, didn't
right.
he? Violating civil law in favor of higher law is a perfectly legitimate thing to do. So mm-hmm. it sort of depends on where you go with it.
Sure. Well, in addition to Herb Titus's legal work with Gun Owners of America, in 2004, Titus helped draft what was called the Constitution Restoration Act for Congress. This bill would have prevented federal courts from hearing any case concerning a government entity or official's acknowledgement of God as the sovereign source of law, liberty, or government. And it would also prohibit any federal judge from drawing upon international law in rendering a constitutional decision. The bill had 9 co-sponsors in the Senate, 50 in the House, including now Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, about whom I'm going to talk a little later in today's show, and Representative Mike Pence, who's thought to be considering a 2012 presidential run. So this is not inconsequential, and it shows, I think, that Herb Titus and his thought are not exactly marginal, that they're being embraced by leading members of both parties.
Well, absolutely. And, of course, that proposed legislation that you're referring to arose out of this controversy with Judge Moore in Alabama for the monument to the Ten Commandments in the middle of the courthouse and the Supreme Court's ruling that that was unconstitutional. So, these controversies are not marginal.
Mm-hmm.
They play very central roles in our political discourse.
From the summer of 2010, that's Dr. Julie Ingersoll on State of Belief Radio. I'm Ray Kirstein, in for Welton Gaddy. Statistics show that each time the headlines are soaked with another bloody mass shooting, sales of firearms shoot up across the nation. And again, certain political leaders pander to the fears demonstrated by these statistics and attempt to strike down common-sense prohibitions on firearms in places like schools, bars, and even houses of worship. Thanks to a lazy media, the claim of many pro-gun conservatives that the community college in Oregon, which was the site of the latest bloodbath, was a gun-free zone, has gone mostly unchallenged. But in fact, a 1989 state law mandates that concealed carry permit holders cannot be restricted from taking their little friend anywhere they darn well please, including college campuses. Still, the scaremongering goes on unabated. In 2010, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal joined this misguided and ongoing campaign to lift the ban on guns in public places, signing a law allowing firearms in the state's churches. Not surprisingly, as a pastor, Welton had a few words to say about it on this show.
Years ago, a mother told me a story about her young son who liked to play cowboys and church. One day she overheard him reenacting Jesus summoning Lazarus from his tomb. The little boy, with a toy gun in each hand pointed across the room, shouted, "Lazarus, come out with your hands up." Well, viewed as a childhood game, the story's funny. Viewed as a child's portrait of the Christian religion, the story's troublesome. How do you move from the image of Jesus of Nazareth, called the Prince of Peace, who taught his followers to be peacemakers and instructed one of his disciples to put away his sword rather than violently attack his enemies, to a portrait of Jesus holding a gun in each hand as threatening enhancement to his demand for obedience? A similar image would be equally problematic if it pictured Moses poised for a vicious attack on people to whom he was yelling Shalom, or of the Prophet Muhammad as he waved a sword while explaining that Islam is a religion of peace. The same principle applies to portraits of Buddha or Nanak, the founder of Sikhism. Well, this week, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal joined several other governors who have signed into law what is called a gun-in-church bill. The Louisiana version of this provision refers specifically to churches, synagogues, and mosques, though the law applies also to temples, shrines, gurdwaras, and other houses of worship. Now, something is bad wrong in this picture, and I think most of us know what it is. Frankly, despite frequently infusing his civic rhetoric with the language of faith, Jindal, like others, shows a surprising lack of knowledge about the essence of faith and priorities of faithfulness. Why would civic leaders not want one of the last institutions devoted to peacemaking to continue that important work in a society addicted to violence and fascinated by guns? Well, of course, any time government becomes involved in religion, we should expect distortions and problems that can compromise the integrity of religion. The founders of our nation knew the reality of that development well and sought to prevent it. It's a crying shame that contemporary leaders have forgotten it. Interestingly, the Louisiana law entrusts the decision about allowing concealed weapons in houses of worship to the leader of each respective house of worship, I guess assuming a religious hierarchy in every congregation, which is not the case. Though in the church I pastor in Louisiana, the congregation is responsible for the leadership of the church, I could not help but wonder why I would want to choose certain people in the church to carry guns, or perhaps to take advantage of the new law for myself by tucking away a little handgun in my clerical robe like a little pocket Bible. Would that be a way to prevent the man on the second row from going to sleep every Sunday morning during the sermon? Or would it be a way to quiet the woman who always raises an irrelevant question in a church business meeting? Or make teenagers a little uneasy about playing electronic games during the choral anthem, or increase the success of a congregation-wide financial campaign? Oh, forgive me, but no, the matter is a serious one. One having to do with what happens in the sacred space designated for worship, amid the peaceful spirit of a faith that wants to change the world, not bend to society's lowest standards of resolving problems. Yes, I understand the violent environment in which some worship centers are located. One time in the past, I had a little bottle rocket shot at me while I was delivering a sermon in a pulpit. It's discomforting. It's scary. But that's not a reason to replace peacemaking with gun-toting. Why, even in the old shoot-em-up West, cowboys and cowgirls respectfully checked their guns at the door of a house of worship, and now not even Texas allows guns in houses of worship. Now, keep in mind, though, that Bobby Jindal does not always see the importance of treating a house of worship any differently than a university, a business, or a civic auditorium. You remember his defense of using taxpayers' dollars to fly around Louisiana giving his Christian testimony exclusively in evangelical churches? A little wonder that he would fail to see a difference between carrying concealed weapons to a church and to a civil protest. But thankfully, no government leader gets the right to determine the sanctity of a place of worship and what happens there. To the state legislature of Louisiana and to Governor Bobby Jindal, as a Christian in that state, as a minister in that state, I must say thanks, but no thanks. This very day, I wrote to members of the Leadership Council in the congregation in which I serve, urging that we quickly post a policy of prohibiting concealed or unconcealed weapons in a place designated for worship by people committed to nonviolence. It's a decision the congregation will need to make because of the government once again intruding into its business. Enough already.
From 2010, that's Welton Gaddy talking about Louisiana's then-new Guns in Churches law. With this show's 10th anniversary coming up in January, we are mining the archives for memorable interviews and commentaries that help illustrate how much things have changed and how much other things have not during the past decade.
It's never been that hard to buy a gun. Now they'll sell a Glock 19 to just about anyone. The seeds of tragedy are there, and what we feel we have the right to bear, to watch our children come to harm. They're in the safety of our arms. With all we disagree about, passions burn, heart goes out. We're a long way gone down this wild road we're on.
In 2013, immediately after the Newtown shootings in Connecticut, Walton Gatty appeared on Rachel Maddow's MSNBC show. Let's take a couple of minutes for the comments he made on that occasion.
Joining us now for the interview is the Reverend Walton Gatty. He's the pastor of the Northminster Baptist Church in Monroe, Louisiana. He's also head of the Interfaith Alliance. Reverend Gatty, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Rachel.
Seeing these folks from Newtown trying to help lead a national response to what happened, do you think that proximity to a tragedy like this lends a kind of moral leadership, a moral signature that can help the rest of us trying to figure out what we ought to do in the wake of this?
I certainly do, Rachel. I think it is certainly moral integrity for them. They have the experience. They know what happened to them. They know what can happen to other people. And so they want to move. There's something else involved also, though, that I think is very therapeutic about this, because so many times when this happens in a community or even just a death among good friends, and people are just, you know, like this as to what I feel so helpless. I don't know what to do. Here's something to do. Here is a situation in which to grieve is to also imagine what can we do to stop needless grieving, needless deaths. The only thing that scares me about this, and it certainly can be overcome, is in Washington, moral authority doesn't really go very far. If it did, we'd be feeding hungry people all over the world already. We would find it harder to go into war, and we would find it easier to get out of war. So these people are filled with passion and with empathy. And I'm glad to know who they went to see today, because so that they can be helped there. But this is not going to be quick. Now, something may happen quickly, but the real solutions are going to take a while, and they're going to be disappointed. They're going to go into a room where there are people they think should be their friends, and they're right, they should be, but they're feeling a political will that is being battered by lobbyists, by the National Rifle Association, by people saying, oh, you're just not realistic about living in this world. We have to have our guns to fight the government. We have to be prepared. And they're going to be sorely disappointed. That's when they have to reach deeply again into their guts and find that passion and say, we're not going to be stopped by that. Mm-hmm. We've got to get this done.
As head of the Interfaith Alliance, I thought about you when watching President Obama addressing that interfaith service on Sunday night in Newtown, quoting from scripture, speaking both as a president but also speaking as a man of faith, yeah, talking to people in a very interfaith, very diverse environment. Do you feel like, especially in moments like this, when people are so emotionally affected, I mean, there are a lot of different types of tragedies that happen over a lot of different time in our country. This one has grabbed people by the heart. To see people so upset, you see a lot of references to faith. You see a lot of people reaching for faith and talking about faith in a way that they is more open than they usually do. Do you feel like the religious community is being constructive and playing an important role in the response so far?
As always, some of it is and some of it is not. Mm-hmm. And there are some people who are still, as religious leaders, carrying political baggage and delivering political mail. And it makes me sick at my stomach to see that. I can't say enough good about Newtown. I mean, I think they have handled this remarkably well. The interfaith component of that service was terribly important. And Rachel, here is a place in which we can find, a nation that's really divided, can find common ground. I don't know of a single religion that is not for protecting life and seeing that children have a right and a opportunity to grow up and become the people they can intended to be. That's why I don't understand people who are carrying political baggage in that situation. And so those of us who see that this needs diversity coming into a unified voice. We've got to speak up.
Reverend Welton Gaddy, pastor of Northminster Baptist Church in Monroe, Louisiana, and the head of the Interfaith Alliance. Thank you, my friend.
Thanks, Rachel.
I've been looking forward to talking to you.
In going back through almost 10 years of State of Belief archives, it was profoundly depressing to realize how many mass shootings we've covered in terms of both grief and strategy. Charleston, Fort Hood, Newtown, Oak Creek, Aurora, Tucson. Now add Roseburg, Oregon to that bloody list. And it goes on and on. And of course, the everyday death toll on our streets is simply staggering. Survivors and allies have grown increasingly organized in pushing for substantive change, but we haven't really seen that change materialize. In a major new push for that long-needed change, on October 22nd and 23rd, Andover Newton Theological School in Boston, Massachusetts, is hosting a two-day summit titled Subverting the Gospel of Guns, and I'm very pleased to welcome the Reverend Martin Copenhaver, president of the school, to State of Belief Radio. Reverend Copenhaver, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Would you start with an overview, please, of what will be happening at the Subverting the Gospel of Guns Summit?
Yeah, certainly. So Andover Newton Theological School is the oldest seminary in the country, outside of Boston. Actually, the oldest graduate school of any kind in this country. And we are situated on the edge of an urban area, but we're aware that this issue of guns knows no borders, and indeed, it's an issue for our whole society, and we're particularly eager to address it within a faith context as a social justice issue that demands the attention of people of faith.
Where did the idea for this summit originate?
Well, I think it arose out of conversations within our wider community of Andover Newton, as I'm sure it is the case all over the country, where there are events of gun violence and are saying, what can we do? It seems like an issue that needs to be addressed, and yet so little has been done thus far to address the issue of gun violence.
Would you talk about who are going to be some of the notable speakers at the summit?
Yeah, we have a kind of an all-star cast. We have Mayor Marty Walsh from the city of Boston, as well as Maura Healey, who is the Attorney General for the state of Massachusetts. The Commissioner of Police for Boston, as well as faith leaders and others. It really is a kind of a gathering of people from different sectors to address this issue that's of a common concern.
It's an intriguing title. Can I ask you to talk about what is meant by that phrase, the gospel of guns?
Well, I think it's really meant to get your attention to juxtapose the gospel of guns, I guess, to the gospel of love or the gospel of Jesus Christ, however you would want to consider that. It's interesting how when people cite the right to bear arms and they quote the Second Amendment, it's almost as if they're quoting sacred writ. It's so much a part of the American culture that it's almost goes beyond questioning. We have now as many guns as people in this country, which is really unprecedented in the world. And there's a reason why we have so many deaths by gun violence. It's the proliferation of guns. Other countries look at us with a kind of a concern and amazement that we let this happen.
Reverend Copenhaver, what role do you see for faith leaders and lay people as well in finally getting things moving on the issue of gun violence in this country?
Yeah. Well, I think it's kind of taking the conversation back from the NRA and the other kind of fanatical voices, it seems to me, that are dominating the conversation, to look at this as a faith issue, as a social justice issue. It is affecting our communities, and particularly those who are most vulnerable in our society are susceptible to gun violence. Interesting, you know, the prophet talked about beating swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks, and in our culture, we seem to be intent on doing just the opposite.
How can our listeners get more information on the Subverting the Gospel of Gun Summit, both ahead of time if they want to attend, and then to keep up on the progress that's made afterwards?
Yeah, Well, indeed, we hope that we'll have the broadest possible participation, and there's been a great deal of interest in this, not only, I think, because of what's currently in the news, but there's a growing sense that people of common sense and of religious faith that they need to come together and to address this issue. When we're there together in this time, we will have a range of suggestions for the ways that folks can get involved, other organizations that are advocating in this area and other faith organizations as well. So we want to see this as much more than just kind of a two-day event that everybody goes home having been edified. We want to equip and empower people who attend to take it from there and to take their concern and turn it into action.
Is there a website they can go to?
Well, for now, it's the Andover Newton website. It's Andover Newton Theological School, which is www.ants.edu, Andover Newton Theological School.
Can I ask you to talk for just a minute about Andover Newton's history of working for social justice in the theological context? You already mentioned it's the oldest school of its kind in the country.
Yeah, well, thank you for that question. Yes, indeed, it's been a longstanding commitment, this commitment to social justice in the school, and it takes various forms depending on what the issues are. It was we're still very much committed to racial justice and economic justice, and that's been part of our sense of calling as a school. I mean, it's a part of the educating of faith leaders to put a focus on these issues that that they will need to address when they are out of the school and feel called to address while they're still at the school.
Is there anything else that we haven't talked about that listeners should know about the upcoming summit?
Well, I think I would just add that this is not only a public policy issue and one that's in the news, but I would hope that folks would see this as a faith issue, as one that needs the perspective of the faith that we have to really help us address it, just as other issues such as racial justice have required that faith dimension to really get some action. And that's what we hope to bring to this issue.
The Reverend Martin Copenhaver is president of Andover Newton Theological School in Boston. Later this month, on October 22nd and 23rd, they're hosting a two-day summit titled Subverting the Gospel of Guns. We'll put up a link with all of the information at stateofbelief.com. Reverend Copenhaver, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Appreciate it. Thanks very much for your interest.
And that's all the time we have for this week's show. We're going to keep going back to our treasure trove of interviews recorded over almost 10 years of State of Belief Radio. And if there's a particular conversation that you remember hearing during those 10 years, let us know. We'll be happy to share it with our newer listeners. You probably know someone who would benefit from hearing what you've just listened to. We encourage you to share this program with them and make it really easy to do that on Facebook and Twitter, and of course on our website at stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is where you'll find information on making a contribution to the show financially. It's donations from listeners that have been an important part of keeping us on the air for almost 10 years now, and we need your help as much as we ever did. The website, one more time, stateofbelief.com. And while you're there, sign up for our free weekly podcasts and find links mentioned during the show, as well as that entire archive of past shows, extended interviews, and transcripts. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And please be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Welton will be back with you on State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, Welton.